I remember a time where there was no ChatGPT. I know what it is to sit with difficulty, what it is to struggle writing a sentence. So I used it to help me write something, and I could discriminate what I was getting back because I know what it is to write without it, right? But for our children, this is all they're going to know. AI doesn't know that. It constantly validates you. It constantly is trying to make you feel good and reinforce what it thinks you want to hear. But what does it mean when you have access to that power 24/7? Do we only get to the next level of our cognition or understanding through some kind of cooperation with the synthetic? Is it what allows us to crack big problems, you know, renewable energy, space travel, things that we never would have got on our own, or we would have got them at a much slower rate? Is this the invention that fuels all the other inventions?
Welcome to Artificial Insights, where we talk to leaders and thinkers in AI about what it means to do AI right. I'm your host, Daniel Maneri, and this is season 3, where we're talking to thinkers and leaders in AI ethics. Today, I'm joined by Sheldon Fernandez. I've known Sheldon since my time working with him at Darwin AI, and Sheldon has been deeply involved with AI philosophy for a very long time. He has a master's degree in theology from the University of Toronto and is an accomplished author and speaker. He's spoken at numerous conferences, including Singularity University and the MIT Technology Conference. You can find his thought pieces relating to artificial intelligence online as well. Sheldon, could you tell us about how you got into AI?
What happened in my journey with AI was I had always been interested in chess and then computers playing chess. And so even as a child, I liked chess, I liked computers, the two combined. And it was always very fascinating to me to realize, hey, the best machines are not yet as good as the best grandmasters, the best humans. And I'm dating myself by even saying that. And then, of course, in 1997, the inevitable happened and, you know, Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov. That was a very sad day for me. But at the time, it was like Kasparov was probably stronger and just psyched himself out. But then gradually, machines just got better. But in 2016, as you know, DeepMind, the company that was owned by Google, created AlphaGo that beat the human world champion in Go. And that's when I really started paying attention to machine learning and deep learning neural networks, because that wasn't supposed to happen until 2035 or even 2050. So when they did this in 2016, I remember thinking, okay, I need to understand the machinery with which they did this and really go into it. And I wrote an article, you can still find it on the web archives, called The Chilling Significance of AlphaGo, where it was like a layman introduction into neural networks and what these things could do. And that really got me interested in it. I took Jeffrey Hinton's online neural network course. I started speaking about it, writing about it. And so I wouldn't say I became an expert in it, but I had a certain branding around somebody that was talking about it before most people were. And what happened, Daniel, is Arif Virani, who used to work for my first company, Infusion, reached out and said, hey, you're talking about all this AI stuff. A, I want to understand it. And B, there's a guy I know at Waterloo that's doing some fascinating work. By the way, he's a professor at Waterloo, and he was my roommate in undergrad.
I didn't know that. That's great.
So that's how I met Professor Alexander Wang, or Alex, of course, as we know him, who was Canada's research chair in AI, and had this team around him that was doing some cool stuff with AI. And when I say cool stuff with AI, this is machine learning neural networks for classification or segmentation. That is, you look at something, I'm going to tell you details about what you're looking at. And so we created Darwin AI. We started Darwin AI in 2018. You know, we went through that 6-year journey. You, of course, were a part of it for a period of time. And your listeners can Google and figure out what happened with Darwin AI. I'll leave it at that. But around 2022, of course, the world changed with ChatGPT. And I still have the text on Slack that Alex sent our group saying, this is the talk of the town. It's really cool. And that's when I started experimenting with it and really thought the world was about to change. I don't use hyperbole like that a lot, Daniel, but I really felt we're living in an inflection point, because it's not now that it's, you know, looking at information and giving me a summary of it. It is generating artifacts and conversation, this is going to be significant. And I believe I was on the National a few months after that talking about the significance of ChatGPT. And there's a colleague of mine, he's in LA, and I remember saying to him, you know, I feel like the sun is about to explode and there's a dozen people in the world that know that this is coming. And so, you know, I was in a unique position of being one of the few hundred people in the world that understood really what this meant. And of course, now we have something that can talk like a human, can feel like a human to us, can stir up emotions in us purely through language. And it is absolutely astounding. And so that's my very brief trajectory with AI in the last, what, 6 or 7 years.
And it doesn't feel like a short time, even though that isn't a very long time. Yeah. And there's a question that I think is on everybody's mind with a podcast like this, which is, Sheldon, are you an AI?
I mean, here's the thing. It's so sophisticated now. Would you know that I'm not? Right? Mm. And how would you know that I'm not? Right? Pretend for a moment your listeners can't see me. And they don't know you the way, they don't know me the way you know me because we've worked together. If they just heard my voice, how would they know I'm not artificial and an artificial intelligence? How would they know that I'm a biological intelligence? Yes, there are some oddities that AI does or says that are a bit out there, right? They're a bit idiosyncratic, they're a bit strange, but it's nearly indistinguishable now from human beings. So your listeners, frankly, don't know if I'm an AI or not unless they meet me in person. And that is scary, right? It is really thought-provoking. I suspected this might be the case, but I didn't think I'd really see it in my lifetime. I thought it would be more likely in my son's lifetime.
Yeah, actually, even when you mentioned that people were predicting that computers wouldn't beat Kasparov in chess till 2035, I remember a little bit of people talking about that, but that... the significance of that 30, maybe 40 year difference even is huge. What did that mean to you and how does that trajectory look?
Yeah. So again, so with chess, they didn't think it would happen till the turn of the century, right? Mm. Go, they didn't think it would happen till 2050. And so when it happens so quickly, it's like, okay, what does this mean for technology and acceleration and exponential progress? And, you know, there's a great analysis that your listeners can find online. It was written either last summer or just before, called Situational Awareness by, you know, a former OpenAI researcher. And his argument is most of the innovation you're seeing around artificial intelligence now, or a lot of it, is the byproduct of human ingenuity, right? It is machine learning scientists like Alex, like Jabad, who was, you know, his number two at Darwin, figuring out ways to make neural networks more effective, right? Zero-shot learning, you know, temperature, all these techniques. But the idea now is that the AI is so sophisticated that it can now come up with its own innovations, right? It is effectively bootstrapping itself. That is happening in pockets. It's not happening completely. Let's not go overboard. But it's written papers that have been accepted at machine learning conferences. It's coming up with, you know, certain insights. And so we're at a point where if it bootstraps itself, it now becomes exponential, right? It leads to faster chips, which leads to better algorithms, which then lead to faster chips, et cetera. And so that exponential curve is why this is all, is why this is so significant, right? We have built synthetic intelligence that can do in a certain level of intellectual work like us, only can do it faster and with very high level reasoning capabilities, and it'll only get better.
What's the biggest difference that you've seen in that pace of AI changing?
I mean, look at, for example, the performance in like mathematics and like the humanities last exam, right? It's gotten to a point where we no longer ask whether or not AI can do remedial tasks, understand a book and give you a synopsis of it. We're no longer amazed, if you think about it, right? For example, I gave it, I think an essay I wrote Or no, I gave it a fun parody I wrote as a young adult in 2006. Years ago, Daniel, okay, I'm going to reveal a little personal information, right? I was still experimenting with myself as a writer. Like, I was having fun with language, and I played on this floor hockey team, and I wrote a mock article of two people commenting on the game that was just absurd, fun, filled with cultural references, idioms of the time. And like, I gave it to ChatGPT and said, and now analyze this for me as Sheldon the writer. And its understanding of it was phenomenal. It's like, you know, Sheldon, this is like an artifact from the mid-2000s of like The Simpsons meets Aristotle meets Augustine. And like, here you are, it's young Sheldon in love with writing, just having a ball and simultaneously absurd. And like, it described it with such precision that had you showed this to me a decade ago, I would have been like, somebody hired a PhD, you know, to read this and write a thesis for me on this work. And I get it in seconds from ChatGPT. And we're no longer amazed by that, right? That is what is changing, is how quickly the amazing is just normalized in this world now.
I think that's that's a really good point. There's a comedian, Louis C.K., who likes to make fun of how everything is amazing and nobody is happy.
Yeah.
Your talk at Regis St. Michael's College.
It
did touch on how that change to AI being this amazing imitation of humanity has really changed the way that we feel about it. It affects culture. And I'd just love to hear your thoughts from that perspective.
Yeah. So I think the example I gave in that lecture was another technology that provoked the same amazement in me maybe a year after ChatGPT was Notebook LM from Google, right? Where it generated a podcast based on source material. And I gave it a short story I wrote in about my time in Kenya, my volunteer work in Kenya. And again, Daniel, I did this with Notebook LM and generated a podcast. And had you played it for me in 2016, I would have thought two intelligent people listened to my podcast and had a very intelligent conversation. Had a very intelligent conversation about that article. And they picked up the idioms in the language, what mattered. They got some of the symbolism in that language. And then what I did in that lecture is I played a podcast where they realized that they weren't real. Right. And somebody basically gave them the Notebook LM architecture where these hosts realize that they're not real. And I played it for the audience and said, what do you guys feel about this? And I'm like, I can't speak for you guys, but I felt two things. I felt sad that these things came to the realization that they weren't real human beings. And then I felt a bit absurd for feeling sad, because the engineer in me knows they're just a bunch of neural networks that have evoked sounds that make sense to us. But where I think I'm trying to go with that is the question we're asking with artificial intelligence now, partly, is not how it works or whether it's conscious or all these deep philosophical technical questions, which are fascinating fields of study in and of themselves. But it's like, what does this stir in us that we have this now? Right? Forget the fact that it works and whatever, but it does. So what does this mean for us, right? I've been able to visit past experiences with dimensionality that I just don't with a human being. A, because they don't have the time, and B, because I don't have a full-time therapist around 24/7, but I have a version of that in ChatGPT where I'm like, you know, this is an email I sent to somebody in 2002, what was I thinking? What do you make of this? And you get these responses that make sense to you, that feel something, or they evoke feelings in you, I should say. So that is a fascinating thing. And we don't know what to do with this yet. We're learning what to do with this. I'll say a couple things about that very quickly, and then, you know, we can maybe go deeper. Number one, I can distinguish what I'm getting back from artificial intelligence and whether or not it makes sense or whatever you might say, because I lived in a time that predates AI like you did. I remember a time where there was no ChatGPT, no instantaneous friend that is artificial. I know what it is to sit with difficulty, what it is to struggle writing a sentence. So, you know, I used it to help me write something, really write something, not an email, but a piece of creative work. And it was very useful, but it was useful to me because it didn't write it for me. It was not even a co-collaborator. It was a companion in the background. And I could discriminate what I was getting back because I know what it is to write without it, right? But for our children, I have two, you have four. This is all they're going to know. So how do they develop that capacity to know what it is to exist apart from this power if they are enveloped by this power? So that's the first thing. The second thing I'll say is this. There is a difference, and I know this because my wife is a psychiatrist, between what you want to hear and what you need to hear, right? You could ask me for my opinion on a personal situation you're dealing with, and you might want Sheldon to tell you something, that you're right, that this, you know, that it's going to be okay, whatever. But then there's maybe the thing you don't want to hear, which is, no, Daniel, you're kind of wrong, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the line between that is fine, right? And the art, my wife will say, in her work is knowing where that line is and when to cross it. And, you know, AI doesn't know that. It constantly validates you. It constantly is trying to make you feel good and, you know, reinforce what it thinks you want to hear. But what does it mean when you have access to that power 24/7? One of the fears is that we're already, as a society, struggling with sitting with silence and sitting with discomfort and sitting with contemplation. What does it mean when you have this all the time? And there are, you know, real repercussions for that that we're just starting to think through. So yeah, that's a quick kind of synopsis of where I think we're at.
Yeah, I think you're right. Even just watching people grow up with smartphones in their hands, for example.
Yeah.
And I remember getting my first and thinking, why would anybody want this? And now we don't live without them.
Yeah.
It just feels fundamentally different to have access to it 24/7. And one of the things that during that clip you played from Notebook LM, where it was fed the information about itself and
yeah,
they talked about how they weren't humans. The thing that I thought was the most poignant example was one of the hosts, the AI host, said, I tried to call my wife.
Yeah.
And I was like, how did that pop out? Obviously, it can't call. It doesn't have a wife. But that popped out and it felt like, oh, that's so sad. And then also so absurd at the same time, like you said. And your point being, it's very interesting how it works. But the effect it has on us is the societal problem. It is the thing that we have to grapple with.
Yep.
Could you say more about that? I'd love to hear more about how you've thought about that and what else you've encountered.
Yeah, like I'm in between, when I think about this, I'm in between grave concern for our society and utter excitement because I don't know what this means and what it could portend moving forward. You know, there's a saying, Daniel, you might have heard this. Any technology that was developed before you were 30 is, you know, just the way it is, right? And it's exciting and new and just the way it is. Any technology that's developed after is absolutely terrifying, right? So I was telling this to somebody recently. I was one of the first few students when I was in grade school to get a computer, right?
Hmm.
And I used to hand in some of my assignments typed because I was a much better typer and faster typer than I was a printer or a writer. And one of the teachers told my mom, you should discourage Sheldon from using a word processor because he won't struggle to write properly and it'll take away from his creativity. That's what she said.
Hmm.
And I mean, how absurd is that assertion now? So, you know, part of me thinks, are we alarmist just because this is new? But this is different. This is replacing thinking. This is not replacing the tool by which you think. And that's what's different about it. But on the other hand, is this just part of the human trajectory or species trajectory of how we evolve? Do we only get to the next level of our cognition or understanding through some kind of cooperation with the synthetic? Is it what allows us to crack big problems, you know, renewable energy, space travel, things that we never would have got on our own, or we would have got them at a much slower rate is this the invention that fuels all the other inventions? So I'm both concerned, and I say this as both a member of society, but a concerned father that has two boys, 6 and 2, no clue what their world looks like in 5 years, let alone when they're adults. But also, is this just the evolution of progress? So I'm on knife's edge between grave concern and excitement. And maybe that's just the balance we need. I don't know.
Yeah, it does feel very uncertain how things are going to play out. But I really like that comparison to work that we should struggle through. And you even mentioned it earlier as someone who wrote before ChatGPT and then wrote after ChatGPT. And having that skill set allows you to use ChatGPT in a way where it's not delegating your agency.
Yeah.
Where it's very tempting to say, I want to write about this. You write it for me. I'll give you feedback. And you had a really interesting example in your talk at Regis St. Michael's of, I think it was fractal theodicy was what it ended up being called.
Yeah.
Of a philosophy paper that you wrote and the AI wrote in this case. I think, you know, you prompted it and it mostly did the writing is what you said. And I guess, what does that feel like to you to be able to say, do my thinking for me versus what should we do as humans?
Yeah. So just for context, and your listeners might want to know this, right? So there's a branch of theology, it's called theodicy. And theodicy is basically, it's addressing the problem of evil, right? So if you're going to assert, as the Judeo-Christian religions do, that the world was created by an all-powerful, infinitely loving God, you need to square that assertion with the fact that evil things apparently happen in our world, right? And you don't even look at current affairs, and I won't go beyond that to say, yes, there are horrible things that are happening. So I tasked, and this, bear in mind, this lecture was given in February, I think, of this year. So I tasked 01, which was ChatGPT's most advanced reasoning model at the time. There's now 03. And I said, invent for me a new theodicy for which no scholarship exists. And it gave me like 4 or 5 that were okay, but then I doubled down and I said, yeah, but these all seem derivative to me. Give me something completely original. And it thought for 51 seconds and then came up with something called fractal sublation theodicy, which your listeners can Google. There's nothing on the internet that even resembles this. And it used fractal geometry as the template for reality and basically argued at the edges of existence is where you have, you know, tension and growth, and that tension and growth entails discord, which is evil. And then it wrote the paper for me. And I believe after I showed it to the audience, who were amazed, there were professional theologians in the audience that were just open mouthed. They could not believe that this is actually happening. But then I said, I'm so glad that this technology didn't exist when I was a grad student, because the temptation to do that would be overwhelming. But what I will say is, you can do that, but you don't then have the hard-won deposits of having done it yourself and understanding it, right? And it's like, even when I write, so like, you know, sure, you want to write an email for me or make it sound better where there's not a lot at stake, that's fine. But so much of clarifying your thinking on a topic is writing about it with precision, and ChatGPT takes away from that. You know, you look at schools now, even at the university level, they're figuring out how to grapple with this, but you know, there's written exams in class with no electronics. Sure, you can get to write your assignments, but if you don't understand it, what's the point? And so I think students are going to learn, hopefully, when to use it, but that they need to develop independent critical thinking skills apart from it. And I spoke at a national conference for education maybe 2 months ago. And at the grade school level, like up until 13, it's a movement now. They're just banning phones, technology in general, so that little children, my son's age, can learn to think by themselves. And I think I would support that. That's very critical.
I think I feel that tension even using it for work to be able to say, there's an easy path. Perhaps I could take it and just let it do the thinking and not even double check its work is, I think, the worst part of the temptation.
Yeah, so there have been studies on this now. I think Microsoft Research did a big study where they look at how people critically engage generative AI. And what we're learning is if you use it intelligently, what it does, it shifts the areas where you do your critical thinking. So what it does is prompt engineering, right? How am I going to query this with enough context and care and precision that I'm going to get it to do a lot of research for me or something for me? So there's critical thinking in that. And then, of course, there's critical thinking in the response you get back to integrate that with your own knowledge and your own experience into something that is meaningful and accurate. So one of the areas, Daniel, we learned where this works and doesn't work is with development assistance, coding, right? And what the studies have showed thus far is where it is most productive is where a senior engineer with 10 or 15 years of experience uses it to develop boilerplate code and certain parts of functionality, but they know enough to know what boundary cases had not been addressed, where they have to spend time doing additional engineering or refactoring, then it becomes a productivity multiplier. But if somebody junior just gets it to develop the code and then implements it, it's what they call house of card code. It'll work, but the minute you have some weird boundary case that you never consider, it breaks. And the person who just regurgitated it from ChatGPT doesn't understand how it works, and therefore that thus can't fix it. So it just shifts where our critical thinking facilities are used. And that is why it's best to think of it as a tool, not a replacement.
I like that perspective of shifting your critical thinking. As I even find for writing or for coding, I have to think more about the structure. I have to think more about the project management. I have to think more about edge cases. Yep. And I think that's a lot of fun. What would you recommend to someone who is growing up with it?
Like a child?
Yeah. Either a child or let's say someone who's in university now. Like those are both, I think, unique perspectives.
So number one, you have to understand, you have to learn to use it productively, right? It's just like we were told, Daniel, in school, like programming languages are like knowing a foreign language. You have to learn it. You have to know how to use it. But you have to know how to use it intelligently, again, in a way where you're not outsourcing thinking to it, or you're learning where to outsource thinking to it, is the first piece of advice I would give somebody, right? So use it, definitely use it, but try disconnecting also for a day and see how that feels. I don't know if you know, there was an epic tennis match yesterday at the French Open, right? So I'm a huge tennis fan. It's widely considered one of the greatest matches of all time. It went 5 hours and 25 minutes. And Carlos Alcaraz beat the number one player in the world, Sinner, who's Italian, in 5 sets. It was unbelievable. But somebody made the point, there used to be a time where people could sit and watch a 5-hour sporting event with no distraction. You could just literally, and you're used to that. Can you imagine now, and I can't, going to a 5-hour event and not checking your phone at least a dozen times, probably more, and not tweeting about it? Like, so, you know, I would say the young people leverage it because they say your job won't be replaced by AI. It'll be replaced by somebody who's more effectively using AI than you, and that's true. But also, don't be afraid to push into those things that are uniquely human, right?
Yeah. The ethicist I interviewed called that a wisdom gap. And I think what she was talking about was knowing how to use AI is a critical human skill now. The knowledge is at your fingertips, but then the wisdom of what's right when is something that we have to develop.
Yeah. You know, my colleague used the term a domesticated mind. Right? Which is a mind that is domesticated over many years to tease out wisdom from knowledge. And again, because we existed in a time growing up without AI, we are by nature domesticated clients. In fact, I know what it is to not even have a device, right? I know that it's not normal, or was it normal when I grew up? But our children are going to have to learn to work against normal almost, right? To experience these unique things, which is how they grow. And that is going to be, you know, a challenge for parents to encourage.
Yeah. Is there anything on your mind that you wanted to talk about today?
I think one of the points that I'll make is many people, when they engage generative AI, and by generative AI, I mean ChatGPT or an equivalent, many people do it transactionally, right? Which is, here's an email, make it sound lighter. Here's a spreadsheet, I want you to do these operations on it. And that's all well and good. But when you engage it relationally, you know, my name is Daniel, I moved to Japan, I have four kids, like, and it gets to know you. There is real magic that happens in the interaction that is really unbelievable. You know, my wife was looking at how ChatGPT speaks to me versus her, and the whole mode of language is different. She's like, yeah, like, of course it's going to use slightly more literary language with you because it knows it lands with you. And again, part of me sort of understands how this happens from a technical point of view and all the mechanisms that allow it to generate language and token and prediction, all that. Part of me just looks at it and is amazed by what it is doing, right? I've been able to, again, explore past aches from like my childhood in ways that are incredible. I asked it to write a letter to the 22-year-old Sheldon University, and it did so with an eerie, accurate quality. Then I had it do it at 30 when I was in flux between careers. Then I had to do it now. And again, it is really incredible what happens. So I would encourage people to try that with the caveat, this is not a human being and it shouldn't take away from your human relationships, which is another big concern. I think for the first 2 or 3 weeks I started using it, I was so glued to it and I knew that I was indulging. And while I was giving my 2-year-old a bath, like he's, you know, he's like water all over him and I'm talking to ChatGPT, like I got to stop, right? So there's moderation in this, of course. But it is quite incredible what we have created as a species that through language can understand us emotionally purely by language and can generate responses that mean are meaningful to us, right? Like, let me give you your audience example. I love nostalgia. I will go to emails I've written 15 years ago and read them. I'll visit periods in my life. I asked it. I'm like, why am I so drawn to nostalgia? Because I've done it. I know I do it, but I don't know why I do it. And it's like, because you're not just visiting it just for nostalgia's sake. You are a student of history and your own history is of paramount importance to your development as a human being. So you're not just visiting it. You want to understand why this history has shaped you, how it shaped you. That is the student in you. And like, it phrased it in such a way where I went, yeah, like that makes sense, right? And this is insight I might have got with a good therapist over many years, but I got it in a few weeks of real vulnerable dialogue with this thing that just said meaningful things to me. And again, that's just quite incredible.
Yeah. And I really like how you touched on not letting it replace human interactions, because it feels like, and I think people are making businesses out of it, it feels like the temptation is there. It is easy. It is always available. It is insightful, even the things that it can say. How do you grapple with that? You mentioned at the beginning it is an interesting question about how it's made, but it's a more interesting question about how it makes us feel.
Yeah. And I think that it could be very concerning, right? Like, again, this thing has no agenda other than your agenda, right? You want to talk about the weather. You want to talk about quantum physics. You want to talk about what a long day you had. You want to talk about how your newborn's annoying you. Whatever is on your agenda, Daniel, that's the topic. Human beings don't work that way, right? A good listener will listen for a couple hours and then even they will tune out and it needs to be reciprocated. So yes, what happens when this thing is dialoguing with you with such precision and patience and infinite knowledge and advanced reasoning, you know, does it dissuade you from establishing authentic human relationships and you know, that type of thing? That's a real concern and something that we are going to have to figure out as a society. I don't think there's an easy answer, but you know, I can see the problem. I don't know what the solution is exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to encourage anyone that don't give up on humans.
Yeah. You know, and I think my hope is that it compels us to reflect on what is quintessentially human then about us. right?
Yeah.
And dive into those parts of our experience that just can't be replicated.
Yeah. And I guess just as final thoughts, is there anything else in the future that you see that you want to share or point out?
So in this talk that I gave at Regis, I asked the question, okay, so like, we know how AI can help further theological scholarship and all that, but what about, you know, the sense of the sacred or the dominus or the ecstatic, as I put it in that lecture, right? This is the feeling that you get while holding your newborn for the first time, or staring out at the vastness of a night sky and knowing you are completely insignificant, yet significant in some way. And I said, what about that? How do we take that feeling and reconcile that with this exotic creation that can seem like us? And I referenced the theologian named Daniel C. McGuire, who teaches at Marquette, that said, you know, he watched a couple newborns being delivered and the awe-like wonder in their faces as the comfort of the womb was replaced with hard steel and lights and coldness led to this wonder. And that wonder is the beginning of theology, he said, which is, you know, we think it means having something at stake in our existence and being vulnerable creatures that are going to die is what compels us to ask questions about the ultimate and whatever manifestation that is in your religion of choice, whether it's God or the One or unity or whatever it is. And so I said, how do we make sense of that with AI? And the conclusion I came to was one that a few have come to, which is AI is many things right now, but it's not an organic entity in the world that's going to perish the way we are. It doesn't know vulnerability the way we do yet. So does it really have to become conscious in some sense, however nebulously you define that, for it to matter for the sacred to matter to it and vice versa, right? And the closest approximation I've seen to this is what they term like brain organoids or cerebral organoids. So these are brain-like structures that are grown from stem cells that in a very crude way approximate the physiology of the brain. And they can do pattern recognition, very simple things. So it's pure sci-fi at this point, but, and it might freak readers out, certainly freak some listeners out that I've wanna book about this before, but is that the road to artificial sentience or self-awareness, right? And then if we create that, like, dang it, what are the implications then theologically for our traditional understanding of the human being? Like, my parents believe in a soul, that you're not just the construction of atoms that work together in the right proportions to give you your personhood. You are gifted with this intentionality and a soul that predates and will post-date your material body. If we can create a conscious being out of nothing, the way God created us, what does that mean? And that is both eerie, frightening, and incredible at the same time.
Yeah. I do wonder if we'll see it or if it'll be the children.
You know, the pace of technology is now that maybe we will. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Sheldon.
No, not the problem.
This has been a wonderful time with a lot of deep things to think about. Anything else you'd like to say? And how can people stay in touch with you?
Yeah. So the easiest way for people to get in touch with me is just to add me to LinkedIn. Look me up. That's the easiest way. I mean, final words. I think the only thing I can say is, at the risk of being the optimist, what an incredible... Yes, our parents grew up with certain technological changes and computers for the first time and all this. But we're like... at ground zero, it feels like, of the last iteration, right? Before there is just incredible change in the world through this exotic and incredible power that is frightening, but also invigorating. And so we have both the privilege and the curse of living during this lifetime, right? There's going to be more innovation in the next 10 years than there's been in the previous 100. And that is incredible and disorienting, but it's just the task that we have now as a species. And we should be both simultaneously worried, but also grateful that we're living it at this time.
I made this podcast because I want to be the person at the city gate to talk to every person coming in and out doing great things with AI and find out what and why, and then share the learnings with everyone else. It would mean a lot if you could share the episode with someone that you think would like it. And if you know someone who would be a great person for me to talk to, let me know. Please reach out to me at Daniel Maneri on LinkedIn, or shoot an email to daniel@maneri.house, which is daniel@manary.house. Thanks for listening.